Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. Now, this particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 30th of September, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of October. For more information and to register, go to biancamarais.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab.
Did you know that 70% of all books, including those traditionally published, are sold online via e-commerce? If you're an author wondering how you can get some of that market share, this is for you. Hi, I'm your co-host, Carly Waters, and I'm here to tell you how writers can work on their author brand and build an audience and convert those followers into book buyers. Ever wonder why so many authors publish books and later say that they didn't sell as many copies as they wanted? It happens over and over, and we see it all over social media. Authors think it's a them problem, but not always. They just weren't shown the way. And I don't want you guys to launch a book and show up at book events and have two people in the chairs. I've helped clients launch client books to the bestseller list for 15 years and have built a 6-module, 11-hour course with all of my knowledge that will give you the craft and book business information that you simply won't find anywhere else. And there's an app plus monthly Q&A sessions with me. 200 of you have already joined my new course. And as writer Siobhan Moore said, I'm halfway through the course and grieving that I didn't have this information sooner. There's really nowhere else to find it. Worth every penny. If you want the info that will change the course of your writing career, go to carlywaters.com/course to learn more and use discount code POD15, that's POD15 at checkout. That's POD15 at checkout over at carlywaters.com/course. I'll see you there.
There and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. We'll be taking a break from recording new Books with Hooks segments over the summer so that we can recharge our batteries and return fully energized in the fall. We'll still be critiquing 2 new Books with Hooks submissions each week, though, which our paid Substack subscribers will get every Tuesday through our newsletter. That's until we return with new segments to air in the fall. So continue to submit your queries to us through our website. In the meantime, we'll be kicking it back by playing Books with Hooks episodes from our backlist while still airing brand new author interviews each week. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another Books with Hooks segment. Doing so much of the podcast editing myself, I hear myself over and over. And something that I appear to love doing is diving into things, even though I myself cannot dive and I'm a very bad swimmer. So, Cece, let us dive into today's first query letter.
Let's do this. Dear Bianca, Carly, and Cece, I completed my debut novel earlier this year, and while waiting for feedback from beta readers, I took the opportunity to geek out on all things writing. I happily stumbled across Bianca's podcast and was excited to hear about Books with Hooks. I would love to hear your feedback on Novel X, which is a work of women's fiction and is complete at 95,000 words. As a counseling psychologist, my fiction is focused on psychological issues and mental health concerns, and the emotional impact these have on individuals and their families, which is similar to the way Lisa Genova writes about neurological conditions in Still Alice and Inside the O'Briens. Novel X also contains some of the mothering angst that is seen in Little Earthquakes by Jennifer Weiner, and it has elements of the HBO series In Treatment, as the reader is able to listen in on the main character's therapy sessions as she works through her issues. Jessica and Glenn Cook are ready to start the next chapter of their life together as they are yearning to start a family. Jessica chose a career where she works with children every day, and they bought a house in a family-friendly neighborhood where the backyard is begging for a swing set. They are devastated when they go through a series of miscarriages and realize they may never be able to have a child of their own. Glenn wants to move on to adoption, but Jessica, who is mired in her grief and depression, is filled with reservations. Jessica faces even more apprehension when she hears that the current view of open adoption involves an ongoing relationship with the birth mother after placement. After so much loss already, this feels too threatening, and she worries that they will never be able to compete against genetics. But the pull to have a child is strong, and she finds herself exploring the possibilities. What follows is a tumultuous journey into the world of open adoption, where she is pushed in ways she never anticipated. And with so many layers of loss, she isn't sure she can ever find her way out. I received my doctorate in counseling psychology in 2001 and have worked in private practice for the last 12 years. I am also a mother to two young children and one labradoodle. While I love to write creatively, my published work is more academic in nature, with a thesis and dissertation in my graduate studies and papers and book reviews for academic journals. I have also contributed editorial pieces to local magazines on such topics as sibling conflict, adolescent depression, and postpartum adjustment. I will soon be starting to work on my second novel while sending out queries for novel X. Thank you for your time in reading my submission. I hope you enjoy the first pages of Novel X. Sincerely, Author X.
Awesome, Cece. Thank you. Right, Carly, what did you think of that query letter?
All right. So I think in the first section here, we have probably a little bit too much. So we have a nice, beautiful introduction, which was great. We have all the facts, the title, women's fiction, the length. I did like the setup as explaining that she's a counseling psychologist. But then I think we end up focusing a lot on the psychology in a way that I just don't think is necessary for a fiction pitch. So yeah, I would probably figure out a way to get rid of the emotional impact these have on individuals and their families, which is similar to the way Lisa Genova writes about the neurological conditions. Like, I think if you just use these comps, like the comp should be enough. If you say, you know, Lisa Genova, Jennifer Weiner, and, you know, the HBO series and treatment, like, I think between all those comps, like, that's kind of the point of comps, is kind of to do that work so you don't have to explain it so much. And then I'm a little bit concerned with this line, as the reader is able to listen in on the main character's therapy sessions as she works through her issues. That's a little bit concerning to me. I'm a little bit concerned that that will A, lag the pace, that B, it might not be as interesting as it potentially could be if it was told in another way. C, is it actually needed and necessary for an actual plot of a book? So, you know, that's kind of like a yellow flag situation for me. And then we get into our next paragraph, and this tends to kind of be a little bit of one of my pet peeves, which is, and I know a lot of women's fiction novels have to kind of be pitched this way because that's kind of how the genre category itself works, but this falls into the trap of our life is perfect until it's not kind of opening. And that is one of those query openers where I'm like, if we could just find another way to do those, I think it would just be so much stronger. So I would say, instead of starting with they're ready to start the next chapter of their life together as they're yearning to start a family, I would just start with Jessica and Glenn Cook are devastated when they go through the series of miscarriages. Like, start with their names, but just cut that beginning and get to the devastation, because nobody really wants to read about a perfect life, right? Like, they want to read about where the trauma and the conflict is. And I think with women's fiction, there's this urge to kind of like set up this, like, everything's fine, right? Until an affair, a death, a birth, something, right? In terms of like, what are these big life events? So because this is such a common story, I really want to know what's unique about this story. Unfortunately, infertility is a common, you know, theme in a lot of women's lives, right? And so this tends to actually, unfortunately, be a bit of a common story. So I'm trying to figure out what's unique about this story. And so I'm, again, trying to kind of comb through this query, figuring out where is the hook. And I think the hook is here, where it says, Jessica faces even more apprehension when she hears that the current view of open adoption involves an ongoing relationship with the birth mother after placement. I think that's the hook, because there's so many, again, so many adoption stories, so many infertility stories, whether it's memoir or fiction. I think what kind of sets this apart is probably this. And again, I don't want to make this book into something. It's not like I'm really just going by the query letter here, but it seems to me that this kind of like relationship with the potential birth mother is kind of what's interesting. So I would go right from Jessica and Glenn Cook are devastated when they go through this experience, and then go right into this apprehension about the birth mother stuff. And then that way we can kind of condense a lot of this commonness of the story and kind of just move on to figuring out what the actual plot of the book is. And overall, you know, the structure is there, and I think that the author bio is great. So I think it's just really narrowing down on what is unique, and women's fiction, this tends to happen a lot.
Awesome, Carleen. Thanks. I'm thinking we should start pitching books as their life was shit, utter shit, until it became perfect. And then I feel like that'll grab the agency's
exactly.
attention. Okay, Cece, what did you think?
Oh gosh, that was funny. So, okay, I think Carly really hit the nail on the head when she mentioned that the arc just isn't there. So for me, the plot paragraph is the most important paragraph in the query for me, right? Like, I'm an agent. I care about all the paragraphs. Don't get me wrong, but I care more about the story. However much I adore my clients, I adore their stories even more. So right now, this writer is taking up a lot of space for a setup when really you're supposed to be showing the arc. And so here's what I mean by that. Like, the first paragraph is all about how they want a child. And I realize that there's detail there that's important, things like the backyard, things like, you know, the fact that she chose a career that she works with children, but it's still 98 words. To say that they want a kid. And so I do think you can like trim that down significantly. And then the next paragraph, I thought, okay, so here we go, right? Like, we're going to get the arc. But really, we just got more feelings, which is important. And I'm not suggesting you remove that. But there's just a lot on like, well, the current view is this. And, you know, after so much loss already, this feels too threatening. So then she worries. Like, we're going through her feelings step by step, which we should when we read the pages. But for the query letter, it's taking up too much space. So I think that it might make sense to start with whatever inciting incident actually happens. Like, you can use two lines for the setup of they want a child, but they've gone through miscarriages, and you know, we'll all be heartbroken when we read that. But then let's get to the plot, right? Like, we need the plot to be there. I was also really wondering about the narration here, because especially now when I heard Carly's critique, I think that the open adoption angle might be really interesting. And clearly it's already there, like it's already in the query letter. So assuming the story matches that, I'm thinking to myself, like, is this going to be narrated by like Jessica alone, Jessica and Glenn, perhaps Jessica and Glenn, and I don't know, some other woman who was pregnant. I don't know. And I don't have to have that answer in the query letter. Like, you're absolutely not under any obligation to say this is narrated by XYZ. But if it is dual POV, I think it would be interesting, because I think it would help with the setup. And again, one of the reasons why I'm struggling and I want to know these things is because I don't know the arc. So when we don't know the arc, we start asking all these questions about the narration, about the setting, because we try to figure out like what the plot is about. I also would suggest adding a content warning, just because miscarriages are, it's something that almost every woman has gone through in some way, whether you feared it or you've gone through it or your best friend or sister. It's just, it's so common, and it's something we don't talk about as much. So I think a content warning would be extra sensitive and nice. And I don't want the writer to worry, because content warnings are something quite recent. So I'm sure that this will not affect your chances in any way, but you know, if you're still going to send something out, I would add a nice content warning. And I really, really love the last paragraph, especially the labradoodle.
Bring on all the dogs. Okay, Carly, what did you think of the opening pages?
This is just completely on me. I didn't know that we were opening with a prologue, just because the way my computer formatted this, the way that I opened it, the prologue title kind of slipped off the page. So I thought we were getting right into the book itself. So I was just like a little bit like, oh, okay, we're just kind of just in a moment here where there's a bunch of moms, you know, at a playground, and this woman is kind of like sitting with like clutching her purse. This kind of what we're getting, and she's seeing all of these kids fighting and arguing and climbing, and she's just like witnessing mothers mothering and nannies nannying and such. So One of the things I was a bit confused about with this prologue is, again, I think this is because the first time I read it, I also thought maybe this was chapter one, but this is very like we are witnessing a scene, which means that we're kind of this external observer, which makes us distant. And I don't really like feeling distant when I'm starting a novel. I really want to feel immersed. So this was but it also does the job of like, we are also this woman, right? We're looking through her eyes and observing the scene. So I'm kind of two minds about it. I think this is just a personal taste thing, which maybe this isn't my favorite type of opening, and that's fine. So I think this is just a taste thing. But for me, I'm like, I kind of wish I was a bit more immersed in the scene. One of the examples I had was just, you know, she's talking about all this action on the playground. Like, can we narrate a scene, whether it's like, two kids fighting or a toddler has a fall and a caretaker rushes to the kid. Like, I just felt like it was so passive and so distant. It was almost very numbing, right? And this character is feeling very numb, but that makes me feel really numb, right? Because that idea is that we are witnessing with them. So that was my main concern. I just kind of wanted to just be in the moment a bit more. And then the next thing I was confused about is I Cece and Bianca maybe can tell me this. I almost felt like we almost switched POVs because it says, two benches down, another woman sat, but her eyes seemed vacant as she stared forward, expressionless. And then I'm like, oh, did we just head hop? Like, I was really confused at that point. But ultimately, my main concern is the same thing that I say every time with prologues, is that the inherent idea of a prologue, again, is distant, is very separate. And also, we're not invested in these characters yet. But this particular prologue is kind of an every woman prologue. And so I'm not against this prologue necessarily, because again, I think it does the job of witnessing a scene that many people can relate to. I'm just kind of like, wishy-washy about whether it's as effective as it possibly could be, but I'm not saying strike through. And then we get into chapter one and she is at the doctor's office. And then we go back to the scene of the miscarriage happening on the page, essentially. And I had a note there about the potential for a content warning. Ultimately, like, I know in the query letter that this is a book about miscarriage. So I almost felt like this query, that's why I didn't mention it in the query like Cece did. Like, I get that it's about that, but I do think that Cece is right. There's no harm in adding a content warning, because I've pitched a book before that had a miscarriage. It wasn't even in the opening pages, I think, but you know, it was near the beginning of the book and an editor commented on it. And this was back kind of before we did trigger warnings and content warnings. So I would say this falls into the category of something that you would want to include a content warning on. So that's kind of my main notes there, but I'm really curious to hear about Cece and Bianca's take on the prologue and whether they were head hopping and all of this other stuff I was confused about.
Yeah, just on that, you know, I read it a few times and you initially think it's kind of close to one of the characters, but because all the mothers are she, it's very confusing to know whether we are doing an omniscient narrator who's hopping into different mothers' heads, or if the she is the one mother who's looking at all the other mothers who are looking at all of the other children. So that's where the confusion comes in. So it could just be that it's close to the one character and she is the she that's being referred to, but because that's not clear, it could be head hopping, which then makes it confusing. I agree very much with Carly there. Cece, what was your take?
I am 100% convinced this is omniscient, and I'm 100% convinced this prologue has to go. So that's my take. Here's why, or at least like significantly revised. And here's why. So in terms of smaller notes, I want to say that, you know, by the second paragraph, I was writing down on the margins, like my heart is like filling up with all this emotion for this woman. So good job, because that's what you want, right? The problem is that it then became repetitive. This is a CC thing, like subtle writing. I do not like repetition. I do not like on the nose. And I'll give you examples of what I mean by repetitive. So paragraph three, her mind was filled with a deep yearning and she whispered to herself, why? Why not me? I, first of all, don't even think we need that, because I was already getting that this was a woman who was torturing herself. She actually uses the word torture by going to a playground and looking at children when she herself can't, at least till now, be a mom, right? So I honestly don't think there's anyone in this world who can't relate. But then on the second page, literally at the end of the, I think it's the fifth paragraph, I don't know. It's, she says it again, why them and not her? So truly, this is not something we need. And I know that this is the other woman, right? Like we're going to another woman. It's what Carly said. It's the every woman's prologue, but it's not effective. It is head hopping. And I am convinced it's head hopping because of the line. There's one line that's like one bench down, there's this woman, two benches down, there's this. And then there's one line that's like on the other side of the park, another woman sat. And we go into her head, right? Like I understand, I think I understand what the author meant, which is probably to show that all these women were sitting there and they weren't talking to each other and they were all in their heads. And it's very powerful symbolism because infertility issues, miscarriages issues, wanting to start a family but not being able to, these are things that are invisibly connecting so many women in the world. And I say invisibly because as a society, we don't talk about it. It's getting a little bit better now, but it is something that we don't discuss as openly as perhaps we should. And so I understand the symbolism, it's beautiful, but it's not making me connect to one person. So if the idea is to make this an every woman's prologue, I thought of two things. One, the POV in the prologue could be the playground. Like you could make the playground a character. And that way the head hopping wouldn't be so, first of all, it wouldn't be head hopping, right? Like the playground itself would come to life and it could be quirky and interesting. Or a child. You could pick one child who's looking at all these women and the child could be walking around the playground, you know, observing all these mommy types, even if they're not all of them are moms. But for a child, every grown woman is a mom. I can't tell you how many times the neighborhood kids have asked me, do you have a kid? And I only have like fur babies, right? So, and they ask this of every woman they look because they look at a woman who's older. So maybe it could be from the child's point of view. If you're set on the prologue, I would say pick one person and not one of the women. Pick either an object, I don't know, a ball or a setting like the playground or a child, because I don't think that this is the best way to do it. And then, oh my gosh, chapter one. Okay, first of all, I want to say I love the doctor as a woman. I want everyone listening to this to please go over their manuscripts and check for all tip authority figures, doctors, engineers, scientists, police people, anyone, and make them women if you can, because this is important for fiction. But also, we're breaking the golden rule of the podcast, which is no flashback. And if this is intentional, that's okay. I'm reading a book right now that starts with a flashback, so I know that sometimes it happens. But I don't think we need the flashback. I think we can start with the flashback if that's important. I will say though, and I hope this doesn't sound super insensitive because maybe it's the intention. And again, so much of publishing is subjective and it's about matchmaking, right? So you have to match the reader with the writer. I think the scene is too graphic for the beginning, especially. It's very well written. It's accurate, but it was intense. Like I read this and I'm usually not someone, like unless it's animal stuff, usually I'm like, I'm fine. But I was like, oh gosh, this was a lot. So your job is to make me feel curious. I didn't feel curious at the end. It's not that there aren't questions to ask. There are questions, but curiosity comes from active emotion. And grief, loss, longing, these are all passive emotions. So you have a big challenge ahead of yourself, which is to create that active emotion. So I don't know, if this is told in more than one POV, maybe start with another POV, someone whose emotions are more, or maybe give her an active goal on the scene, even if her emotions are passive, which is totally fine because a lot of the times our emotions are. Maybe give her an active goal.
Okay, thanks, Cece. Something I just want to talk about is writing on a line level. I firmly believe that 9 times out of 10, when agents turn down something that they're looking at, it's because the writing just isn't there at the line level. Because as an agent, you can speak to people about characterization and pacing and tension and structure, but writing at a line level is really, really tough to correct. And that's why this is a course I'm going to have coming up, because it's a thing I see most recurring in my students' writing. And I just want to give examples here, just because this is something that many, many, many writers do. And I think that, you know, most of our listeners can go back to their own manuscripts and learn from this and apply it. So here we go. We've got a sentence. She felt her breath catch. She could feel the tears coming. Stay away from words like she felt, she saw, she heard, she whatever. Just go straight into it. Her breath caught and the tears came. Okay, the fact that we are being told about it tells us that she could feel it happening. Things like, as well, a lot of emerging writers tend to focus on parts of the body as if they're doing things of their own accord. So, you know, things like her hand went to her belly. Just she touched her belly, which was hard and protruding, as opposed to like her hand acting kind of on its own. And things like her eyes wandered to another woman sitting on a bench nearby. You know, this is something that Dean Koontz has huge issues with. He talks about how eyes can't wander of their own accord. They don't pop out of our head and go wandering to someone else. So yes, her gaze wandered, but her eyes did not wander. You know, so try and look for those kinds of phrases in your manuscript and take them out and just go straight to the thing that you are describing, as opposed to she saw, you know, for example, the leaves falling from the trees, just the leaves fell from the trees. The fact that we've been told about it means she saw it. Okay, so that's just advice for all of you out there to check your manuscripts for that. Okay, Carly, would you like to read the next query letter for us?
Dear Bianca, Carly, and Cecilia, my name is Jay Campbell, and my debut novel, Lost in the Woods, is a new adult contemporary fiction coming in at 65,000 words. Lost in the Woods emphasizes the importance of genuine human connection and a deep respect for nature. The tone of the novel is meant to be lighthearted but emotionally reflective, taking on a slower pace in order to highlight character development. The novel tackles topics such as identity, sexuality, relationship dynamics, family bonds, and nature's impact on mental health and understanding of self. This novel strives to emulate the wholesome atmosphere of Schitt's Creek, the masterful way Richard Wagamese depicts nature, trauma, and family dynamics in Keeper and Me, and also aspires to explore life and loss similarly to Lily King's Writers and Lovers. 24-year-old Rhiannon Griffin and her teenage twin sisters, Layla and Iris, are looking for a fresh start after experiencing a dramatic shift in their familial foundation. Feeling stuck in their lives in the city, the sisters decide to move to a small fictional town in northern Ontario called Greenridge for some much-needed tranquility and clarity. In desperate need of a place to stay, the sisters find themselves at a rustic, and not in a good way, former hunt camp on a lake miles away from civilization. The owner, Lorna, offers them a free place to stay in exchange for their help in bringing the property to its full potential. Through navigating the change of pace into small town life, connecting with nature, and the ups and downs that come with northern living, the sisters are able to work towards forming their own identities. After being a caregiver for her ailing father and younger sisters for the last 8 years, Rhiannon finally has space to focus on herself and her own needs and aspirations. While Layla and Iris, each at critical stages in their development, have the chance to completely start over and form meaningful connections with others for what seems like the first time. As the town slowly grows to feel like their home, each of the girls are faced with life-changing decisions that will potentially take them away from this safe haven. New friendships, romantic relationships, and other emotional ties make their decision that much more difficult. Either way, Greenridge will forever take up space in their hearts for being the home they never knew they deserved. At 22 years old, I have lived most of my life in Toronto with my family. However, my heart has belonged to the North since I was very young. Spending so much time immersed in nature has shaped the person I've become and also been the main inspiration for this novel. I recently completed my BA in English Literature from Trent University, and since graduating, my love for writing and literature has only continued to grow. I currently have been taking time to work on my writing before starting my MA in Creative Writing at the University of Roehampton, London in September 2021. As a proud baldy, I'm also passionate about spreading awareness and normalizing baldness in women and youth through my social media platforms, mainly on my YouTube channel, Bald and Bougie. Thank you so much for your time and feedback. All the best, Jay Campbell.
Awesome, Carly. Thanks. Cece, what were your thoughts on the query list?
Small things. One thing that I think really helps with readability is to put the title in all caps. The writer here put it in quotation marks. And I know it sounds so silly, but we talk about readability all the time and there's a reason. Like, please remember you are sending this to over-caffeinated agents who are reading, I don't know, a batch of 50 or so queries at a time. So it would help if you did that. The first paragraph, the first sentence tells me the title, genre, and word count. Great. As of sentence two, it gets a little tricky, and I'll tell you why. We have five other sentences, right? Like as of sentence two. One of them tells me the theme of the story. The other one tells me the tone of the story. The other one tells me the pace. And another one tells me the topic. And then the final one tells me the goal. The final one, like, I'll give you a pass because it's really just the comps. You're just really just writing them like a goal. Like, this novel aspires to be, which is fine. I personally think you could just say it's for fans of, but okay. But I don't want to be told the theme and the tone and the pace and the topic. I'm sorry. I want you to just tell me the story. I understand why you did this. I think it's great that you've dissected your work and understand the themes. It's amazing, but it's vague. It's vague, and it's also missing the point. The point is we want to connect to the hero's journey, right? And then when we get to the second paragraph, I'm also like, oh gosh, so like, I'm hoping for more specificity, but it's Rihanna and after experiencing a dramatic shift in the familial foundation. Like, are you not telling me what that shift was on purpose? Because I want to know what that shift was. It seems to be part of the setup, so it's okay to tell me. Like, now I think it's her dad dying, right? Like, having read the pages, but I have no idea still. And then again, the next sentence, feeling stuck in their lives. Like, that's vague. How are they stuck? Like, it could be so many things. And then the next sentence, again, desperate need of a place to stay. I'm like, desperate? That seems dramatic. I like desperate. Desperate is great for stories, but like, how is it desperate? I don't get it. So things start shaping up when like Lorna offers them a free place to stay. So I'm like, okay, I think I start getting the hook here. This is starting to shape up, but then it goes vague again. Like, they're unable to, working towards forming their own identities. What does that mean? Like, they're going to start over and form meaningful connections. I'm like, again, it's not that these things aren't important, but they could describe, I think, all of the books in the bookshelf behind me, and nobody can see me, so I don't know why I'm pointing, but there are tons of books behind me and meaningful connections, exploring identity. Like, these are themes that so many books tackle. And I don't mean to say, oh, your story's been done. No. I mean, like, focus on the plot, focus on the specific events. If you're worried about spoilers, I get it, but it's not spoilers unless you're giving away something that happens like with a plot twist as of the climax. I also don't think that the sentence that starts with either way, Green Ridge will forever take up space in their hearts. That sentence kind of removes any of the tension that you had set up, like, because you're saying either way it works, it's all good. And so don't do that. Yeah, I really liked the last paragraph. That was great. I do think, however, that this query letter needs to be rewritten to focus on the story and not on theme, tone, pace, emotion, like none of that.
Awesome. Cece, Carly, what were your thoughts?
I had a lot of similar thoughts. I really liked the Schitt's Creek reference. I think if you're talking about small towns and, I don't know, that kind of identity, I just thought that was so good. And it also seems like the girls escaped the city to get to the country. And I love that. And I love themes of nature. I mean, if you've read my clients like Lendi Vandera, you know how much I love nature. So I think all of that is wonderful. And I think there's so much to discover about ourselves in nature. That said, I don't think we need to tell the agent that. I think that should come through in the writing itself. So I definitely agree with Cece in a lot of this. I also think you need to tell us what the dramatic shift in the familial foundation is. As Cece said, we kind of know it's the dad dying, but they had to have a mother at some point, biologically or adoptive or some point. So I don't really know what happened to the mother as well. So I wasn't sure if there was something there. I was trying to figure out like what the hook was, as I usually do. And I think Cece hit the nail on the head here. It's they try to find themselves somewhere to stay. They find themselves in a hunt camp and they have to update the place, you know, in order to earn their keep. I think that's great. I think it's, you know, three young women move to a hunt camp to revitalize it. And I think, you know, there's a lot to play around with in terms of the emotionality and the literary sense of this book, but the book still has to be about something, right? The book is not about feelings. The book is about these girls. And I say girls loosely, obviously there's two younger ones and a 24-year-old. So I'm saying, you know, girls, women collectively. But yeah, this is about three young women moving to the country with no money, no identity. They need somewhere to live. And, you know, and someone takes them in. So I think that's what it's about. And through this really cohesive hook, you're able to then execute this literary vision that you have for the project. But the book still has to be about something. I was also confused on whether this was a multi-POV project or not. You know, we talk about Rhiannon finally has space to focus on herself, her own needs and aspirations. And then it says, well, Layla and Iris, each at critical stages in their development. Like, how do we explore these coming of age stories of the three women? these three young women. I'm just still a bit confused on the actual execution of this. And when we take so much time in this query that are talking about feelings and themes, what I'm missing is kind of what I need, which is learning more about this POV and the structure and exactly how you're going to execute this vision for this literary project. So a lot of this just ends up being not specific enough and a lot of lists and collection of thoughts and ideas. So for me, it really just, I would just rewrite the whole thing. And I say that with love because really it's just, we have to figure out what this book is about, right? You're pitching a book, you're not pitching feelings. So pitch me the book, tell me what happens in the book without giving the ending away, make it dramatic. And then once the agent requests the pages, they're going to get all of this wonderful stuff that you've built into this project. But the query letter isn't the time to show all your cards, right? The query letter is the time to execute a query letter. And that's what your job is in this point. And otherwise, it seems like you have a really interesting hook here, right? It's just a little bit buried. And that's what we want to kind of like tease out, kind of massage out of this query to figure out exactly what it is and how it can come to life in the biggest possible way. I loved your author bio paragraph. I thought it was great. I would cut the line that says, and since graduating, my love for writing and literature has only continued to grow. We just don't need that. And I looked up your YouTube page and it's awesome. So you should probably include a link to that when you're pitching agents. I thought that was really great.
Awesome, Carly. Thank you. Right, Cece, what did you think of the opening pages?
All right, so we're at a funeral. The first thing that I wasn't sure was whose head we were in. And I thought it was Rhiannon at first, and I think it was, but then we started head hopping to Layla and Iris. If it's intentional to keep it omniscient, I would try to either make it one chapter per POV or add line breaks, or if you don't want to do any of that, really, really make it, I think, clearer whose head we're in at the beginning of each paragraph, because I got really confused and I had to go back and read it again. And that's something you don't want. I'm mindful that the query letter said that this is intentionally going at a slower pace. And I want to honor the writer's vision because the writer is the god of this world and their vision is the only one that matters at the end of the day. Personally, for me, I still feel like the pace can be slow, but without so much telling, especially background information. I don't think we need background information. And there was just a lot. And there are some really cute sentences. Like, for example, there's a line that says, everyone in their lives had either died or left, so there was no one she could turn to for stories. And that's something that's so true. When you lose, especially when you're young, is when you lose someone older than you, you lose their stories. And that is such a powerful sentiment. So it's not that I didn't appreciate the things that were being said. I just think it can be compressed. I don't think we need to know that, that Rhiannon had just managed to finish high school. That was a miracle of itself. Like, it's just a lot of background info. Two, and I've said this so many times on the podcast at this point, grief is not an active emotion. It can't be, right? Like no one goes to a funeral and wonders, oh my God, I hope what's going to happen next. Like that just doesn't happen. There's two challenges here. It's hard to connect when it's a passive emotion, and it's also hard to connect when we're head hopping. So I wouldn't be mindful of that. I had questions like, from this point forward, they were effectively orphans. And I was thinking to myself, weren't they effectively orphans when the dad died? But maybe it's because the burial made it real. But then I think, you know, seeing their dad's body being lowered to the ground made it real. Like, I think that a line like that might help. Not because I was confused. I wasn't confused. I could understand the symbolism. But because I think that you were telling me so much about things that weren't important, but then you didn't when it came to this. I thought it was really interesting that they had never been to a funeral before, like their first funeral being their dad's funeral. So I would just maybe try to flesh that out as the chapter's hook, almost like it was the sister's first funeral as the first line. I think that would make it be like really interesting. I'm on page six. There's small dialogue that's like, ready to head out. Rhiannon asked, yeah, let's go, Iris said. I think this is breaking, again, another one of the golden rules of the podcast, which is that dialogue needs to do at least two things. And one thing is always going to be to say what the people are saying. And the other thing has to be, I don't know, either something with characterization, character development, explaining what's being left unsaid, setting something, right? Like, the dialogue can't be used for just one thing. It's not efficient. But again, maybe this is intentional. And if it is, that's okay. I don't feel connected to any of these women because I am in all their heads. And I need to know how they're going to feel, especially in a sibling relationship. I need to know how they feel about each other. And so if I don't know whose head we're in, I don't know whether the thing that's being said about Iris is how Iris feels about herself or whether it's how Layla feels about Iris. And that matters so much. So again, omniscient can be done. There are some great books out there that are omniscient, but you can't ever have a doubt about whose head you're in. You can't. That confusion can't be there. And for me, it's here. So that would be my note. And I hope it's helpful.
Yeah, I feel for the author because I know how difficult it is to write funeral scenes. My debut had a funeral scene in which a 9-year-old girl is at her parents' funeral. And I wrote that to be comedic, which was especially tough. So I really, really feel your pain there. Carly, what were your thoughts on the pages?
Well, firstly, I want to say, Cece, I love that we're starting to collect golden rules of the podcast. And I just had this idea that we should do some sort of contest and like try to get everybody to collect the golden rules of the podcast so we can pull them all together. So we'll think of something we can do for that. But if anybody wants to start listening for gems, because Cece and I don't like to listen to ourselves in recording, so let us know what the gems are that you guys hear that we say. Off to the pages here. I really liked the first paragraph. I also kind of really liked the first page. You know, this is a 22-year-old author who is very talented. You know, there's a lot of really quality work here. So I just want to, you know, say, you know, you have some skills and we're just trying to help you execute them a little bit better in a way that makes them more saleable, right? So I think I had the same echoes as Cece kind of as these pages go on, which is about the head hopping. I am confused about the POV. I just really wanted to feel a lot more invested in this, but I think not knowing whose head we're in, you know, I'm confused. Being omniscient in a scene that's very emotionally driven is very hard for me to kind of fully feel invested in this. And I also felt we were too long in this scene, you know, where I really felt like we should be having, you know, we should be in the moment. And then the girls can talk on the way back to the car, you know, getting drenched in the rain, you know, holding their umbrellas. Like there is a really cinematic appeal to this. And the author is very self-aware. They even said like how ironic it is that it's raining in a funeral scene, but the author like created this world. So this is all their vision. Like there's a lot of real skill here that I wanted to compliment. But I do think, yeah, we kind of got to be in and out of the scene faster. We need to know who's speaking. And as Cece said, we need to know what everybody's relationship is to each other. And because this is more literary, it's okay to start slower in terms of figuring out and feeling out exactly like what this book is. And part of the curiosity of literary fiction is starting to figure out how we can get our claws into this book and the author teasing us in terms of kind of like slowly building out what the drama is. So there's a lot here that's working, but I think I would just echo all of Cece's thoughts here and just kind of make sure we are feeling invested and we know who's speaking.
Great way to do head hopping in a scene that's got three characters in a way that the reader doesn't get lost is you just do those scene breaks. So it's one kind of chunk that is one particular sister. Then you separate that with the hashtag going to another bit of chunk of information. That's the other sister. So it's like you get a 360 view of what's happening in all of their heads, but the reader's never confused as to whose head they're in at each, you know, particular moment. Jodi Picoult does that quite well in terms of her structure, how she breaks it up into these little chunks of scenes within scenes. So that's something you can use quite effectively there as well. All right, I am going to read the third query letter. Here we go. Dear Bianca, Cece, and Carly, thank you for all the valuable information you share in the podcast and especially for the Books with Hook segment. I'd love a query critique because after consulting PS Literary's submission guidelines, I need help condensing my 3-paragraph brief overview into 1 paragraph. And of course, feedback on the query itself would be very helpful. The query and first 5 pages are below. I'm seeking representation for Everybody Knows, a 95,000 word upmarket novel about friendship and change in which the owner of a vintage trailer park must find a way to save it from redevelopment when her small town is invaded by hipsters in search of rustic charm and hashtag MTN life. It will appeal to readers of J. Ryan Straddle's The Lager Queen of Minnesota and Julie Langdorf's White Elephant, a novel. For as long as she can remember, Benita Baker has dreamed of being a globe-trotting explorer, but one thing or another has been in her way. The patriarchy, a husband, a child, elderly in-laws, a trailer park. A few years ago, she and her husband finally had money in the bank and plans to see the world, or at least North America, after they paid off their mortgage. Then her husband died expensively, so she had to adjust to living alone for the first time and delay her goals again. Now she has a new problem, a big, smelly problem. The Juniper Gulch trailer court septic system has gone bad, and she doesn't have the cash to fix it. When she turns to her brother-in-law, her mortgage holder, and the local mayor for help, he wants her to sell the place. Gentrification is creeping uphill from Denver to their little mining town. Real estate prices are rising, and he thinks that the gulch would look a lot better lined with McMansions than cluttered with trailers. If Benita sold out, she could travel for a while, but then she'd be homeless along with her residents, 25 families she considers her own, and she'd be jobless. Trailer park wrangler is the only career she's ever had. She'd have to start over somewhere cheaper than Colorado and far from her besties, wisecracking, mischief-making, dope-smoking grandmothers she's been merrily raising hell with since kindergarten. She has to find a way to save the gulch without relinquishing her dreams. I moved to the foothills during Colorado's previous population boom to work in the construction industry. Now I write in a sunny corner with my earbuds blasting to muffle my dogs barking at wildlife and my family chattering at coworkers and classmates. This is my first novel. Thanks for your consideration, Lisa. Okay, Carly, why don't you let us know what you think of that query letter?
Well, it started off for me with a great title. As soon as I read Everybody Knows, the next thing I did was go to YouTube and play Leonard Cohen's Everybody Knows. So I was just like bopping to Leonard Cohen while I was reading this one. So I don't know. I was just in the right mood for this. I loved it. Everything here, you know, the 95,000 word upmarket novel. Great. Like this first paragraph is like textbook execution perfect in terms of how to get right to the hook. Great comps. And I just had like, oh yes, in the comments, in my notes here, because I just thought it was super well done as I bopped to Leonard Cohen. Overall, like this is really interesting, right? Like we don't read a lot about upmarket novels in a vintage trailer park in a very self-aware, that's like hashtag mountain life. You know what I mean? Like this is a very self-aware concept, which I really liked. I wasn't sure if this was comedic or not. That was something I was confused about. I'm leaning towards thinking it possibly is comedic, but again, I didn't want to make assumptions about it. And I always say like, you don't want to call your novel funny, but I just kind of wanted to know, is it darkly comedic, right? We have this line, her husband dies expensively. Like how brilliant is that, right? It could be he had a very slow, painful death with very expensive hospital bills, or it could be like he went down in a hot air balloon of blazing glory, right? So I want to know, like, what is this expensive death and is it comedic or not? Because I love dark comedy. And so if he's going down in a blaze of glory, it's kind of funny, right? That dark, you know, funeral humor. Also like poop is funny, right? Like this septic tank gone bad is kind of hilarious. One of my friends, Anna Maximew, wrote a memoir called Dirty Work. And there's a chapter just about like the septic system at a fishing lodge. Like it's funny, right? It's funny. So I, again, but not sure whether this author is like pushing me into direction of whether it's funny or not. I'm hoping it's funny because again, I think that gives it an extra edge, but I just wanted like a teeny bit more direction in terms of whether I should feel that it's funny or not. And that was kind of my main notes. The next note was just how old is she? She says her friends are grandmas and she had or has elderly in-laws. So I'm getting the sense that she's probably comparable to this grandmother's age, but you know, you can be a grandma at many different ages. So I wasn't really sure exactly how old she was. And I also wasn't sure where her child was because she said things have been in the way, right? A husband, a child, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So is this child still in her life? Again, maybe all of this is to come, but as Cece says, you know, questions are good. Curiosity is good. So this built a really strong foundation for me. And I would absolutely request the pages.
Awesome. All right, Cece, what was your thought on the query?
So I think this is a really well-written query. And I, you know, before we get into the query itself, there's a paragraph that's just for us. And she says, I need help condensing my three paragraphs into one paragraph. And this is because On our website, if you go to the PS Literary website, we suggest like three paragraphs, like one for the, you know, title, genre, word count, et cetera, one for the plot, and one for like about you. I just want to say, because of the way my brain is wired, I am also very literal minded. And so I empathize so much with the author's request. So I actually went back and checked the last three authors I signed from the slush pile to see if they had written three paragraphs exactly, because I don't think you have to follow that literally. So one person had five paragraphs and a thank you line in 330 words. Another person had three paragraphs, they managed to do it, and a thank you line in 237 words. And the third person had four paragraphs and a thank you line in 338 words. So my just wish is just to say that you have 376 words. Sorry, you're fine in terms of the word count. And it's okay to have five paragraphs. Like if you want to split the plot paragraph into two, you're allowed to do that. It's really more about like not going over the, not making it too long. It's not really about the number of paragraphs. So anyway, I am very literal minded. It's something I struggle with all the time. So, and it was way better when I was a lawyer because you're supposed to be literal minded as a lawyer. But I just want to like reassure the writer that you don't actually have to do it in three paragraphs if that's not what's best for your query. Although you can really, really like everything that's here. I was super curious about her age too. I figured that her kid was probably just grown, and probably like still in her life, but like doing their own thing because she was about to travel the world, right? So again, just an assumption. I have no idea. I almost wonder though, and this is just me being like more stakes. If we couldn't like heighten the tension even more by saying that, I don't know, the developer or is like a cute guy she went to school with, and or like a rival, that's even better than a cute guy. I don't know. I just wanted like more pressure cooker situation because the setup and the inciting incident is so great. And I love that she's like fighting for like her home and the town's identity. And that's amazing. It gave me like All Adults Here vibes by Emma Straub, I think. So I really like this, and I don't feel like anything's missing, but because we are critiquing, if there's anything else that happens in the present day, you could add a line about that. Although again, you don't have to. This is really great. This is really, really great.
See, with my morbid sense of humor, I'm like, you should change this title to Shit Happens. No, don't change the title to Shit Happens. I'm just joking. Okay. Carly, what are your thoughts on the opening pages?
So we start off with a little classified ad, which is an advertisement to rent a quote unquote tiny home. I'm putting the quotes in because obviously it's the trailer. But I think this is kind of poking fun at that like HDTV kind of angle where it's like tiny home for rent. It's a vintage trailer. So I just thought, again, this is piquing all of my curiosity because like I just want to know. Yeah, I just have a feeling this is like a really funny, smart book. I just have that feeling about this. And then we get into a description of the scene. So we're talking about, you know, we're kind of getting a description. I guess this is third person. Yeah, we're getting a third person kind of point of view here. We're describing what everything looks like. The sun hasn't come up yet, but we're kind of checking out exactly what these sheet metal covers look like on these trailers in the park and things like that. So I do feel like we're spending too much time in the setup here. I really wish that we were moving right into like dialogue and action, because it seems like there's some really interesting characters on this trailer park kind of community, and I would love to meet some of them ASAP. And also there's just so much you can do through dialogue here, right? Like it could be somebody complaining about their neighbors, you know, because what she's kind of doing here is she's saying like she's talking about the structures and are they run down or improving them and things like that. So I think that, you know, even just having an argument between two neighbors about like what they think about their potted plants out front or something like that could be really great in a way to kind of show that aesthetic conversation that she's having with herself, but having it in dialogue and meeting some characters and really just like immersing us in this, because she's trying to immerse us in what everything looks like. But I also want to know what it feels like and it sounds like and it smells like. And I don't know. I mean, I really just think there's so much here that's really unique and special. And I just didn't really feel like we tackled this from like a five senses point of view. But yeah, overall, I'm really curious about this book. I think it has something special and something interesting.
Awesome. Thanks, Carly. Cece, what were your thoughts?
I want to echo all of Carly's notes. Yeah. So I was reading this and writing, and I always write notes on the margins. And I think the description is really beautiful and really well done. This author can write. I laughed when there was a line that said, too bad there weren't any reality shows when she and Doyle took over, because it's true, right? Like, if this had happened in our reality TV show world with HGTV, she might have become like the trailer park queen or whatever. And it's funny. And I really, really like seeing her interact with her surroundings, because I'm guessing that this might be a situation where the trailer park is a character too. And that's interesting. And we know that the plot is connected to the setting, right? So that's interesting as well. However, even when a setting is a character, even when a setting is essential to plot, you still want to start with human interaction. So again, echoing Carly's notes, I kept thinking, like, she would sometimes mention interactions that happened, like a neighbor complaining. Like, there was an example where she mentioned, like, the only time she'd gone to visit her son and granddaughter for a week, she came back to find that Hector in number 17 had loaded his roof with tires. And then there's a whole thing about the interaction, which is very short, but I'm like, why don't we start with an interaction like that, right? Because that's just more interesting. So then by the last paragraph, on the very last paragraph, we see someone showing up. Her dogs bark, and then Bonita looks at, you know, just follows her dogs, assuming that they saw wildlife or something. But really, there's this woman walking along the creek, and the dogs are being lovely to her. And this woman is wearing, I think, like, we get a description of what she's wearing, and her footwear isn't appropriate, which makes me think this is someone who is not in her element in this setting, which is interesting, right? Like, you want that imbalance. You want the person who is wearing inappropriate footwear or inappropriate outfits, because it shows that they don't belong there. And whenever someone doesn't belong in a place, that means there's usually something interesting coming. So my advice, and I say this like it's so easy, and believe me, I know it's not, but my advice is to compress the 5 pages of description and explanation and background, et cetera, into one. I know, right? Like, I say this like, oh yeah, just make 5 pages one. And then have us meet this woman, whoever this, I'm curious, who's this woman? I want to see that interaction. So yeah, maybe even like 3/4 of a page, just to add to that challenge. This is the shit no one tells you about writing challenge. Compress 5 pages into one.
So is it fair to say that this is kind of a Shark Tank agenting moment? Would you both request this manuscript?
I would definitely request it. Yeah.
I would definitely request it. I think there's so many things that are really interesting here. There's the, like, pitting the HGTV against, like, the classism angle. Like, I think that's really interesting. I think this tone of, like, is it comedic or not, is really interesting. This woman, like, this is essentially a women's fiction, I'm using air quotes here, in terms of this is a female character trying to figure out, like, what's going on with her life. She's essentially a businesswoman running her own business. Like, there's so much here that is so interesting from just, like, a female character point of view. But it's absolutely an upmarket novel as it was pitched, right? But I'm just saying, like, it is a women's journey, really just, like, layered with so many complexities. And I think a lot of times women's fiction novelists or aspiring women's fiction authors feel like they have to tackle, like, a woman's contemporary life in a way that is very cookie cutter or suburban, right? But, like, I just love this setting and how unique it is. And I think, yeah, I'd fight CC for it.
Amazing, Lisa. Congratulations. You have options, baby.
After spending our summer vacation this year in Europe, it opened my eyes and my kids' eyes to the power of language and finding common ground no matter who we are and where we are. One of the most important things to me as a parent of two is making sure my kids see other places in the world and are exposed to the languages they speak around the globe. They're in French immersion education, and I'm honestly already getting left behind. I took French class in school until grade 9, and I have a big gap in my learning that I'm ready to fill. And that's why I rely on Rosetta Stone, the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, and it truly immerses you in the languages that you want to learn. I know my kids' language learning skills are going to explode past me, and I'm ready to catch them, and that's why we have Rosetta Stone. It's a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. We're talking Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, and many, many more. There is fast language acquisition. Rosetta Stone immerses you in many ways. There are no English translations, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in that language. There's an intuitive process. You're picking up a language naturally, first with words, and then with phrases, and then sentences, and it is designed for long-term retention. There is speech recognition technology. It is called True Accent. It is built in. It's a feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. It's convenient. There is super flexible learning anytime, anywhere. Learn on the go with a mobile app or on your desktop at your schedule. There is amazing value because you have lifetime membership for all 25 languages for any and all trips and languages that you need in life. That is a steal. That is 25 language courses from Rosetta Stone that they offer it for 50% off. So don't put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. So go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
Fantasy writers, I hope you'll be joining me for the All About Fantasy full-day virtual retreat on the 28th of September from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Whether you write YA fantasy, romantasy, adult fantasy, epic fantasy, cozy fantasy, dystopian fiction, or any other variation of the genre, you won't want to miss out on this amazing day of learning dedicated especially to you and those writing in your genre. The lineup includes award-winning and best-selling authors, as well as literary agents and editors who specialize in the genre. You'll have an opportunity to submit your query letter for critique. The Story Engine, who is sponsoring the retreat, is also hosting an awesome giveaway of an All Things Fantasy storytelling package that contains a copy of each of their decks, Story Engine Deck and Deck of Worlds, each with their associated fantasy expansions, the mythology, dystopian, and fairy tale boosters, valued at $237. All delegates will also receive discounts when shopping on the Story Engine website. Come and learn, ask questions, and even more importantly, build community. To find out more and to register, go to my website, biancamaray.com, and look for the All About Fantasy tab. I hope to see you there. Super excited about today's guest, who I am a huge fan of. She's the author of novels The Adults, a New York Times Editor's Choice, and a Barnes & Noble Discover Pick, and Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance, which was named a best book of 2022 by the Chicago Tribune and NPR. Her short stories and essays have appeared in McSweeney's, Vogue, Outside, Joyland, and other places. She is currently a professor of creative writing at Providence College in Rhode Island. It's my pleasure to welcome Alison Espach. Alison, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Bianca.
Thank you for joining us. Like I said, I am a huge fan. I discovered your work with Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance, and I was absolutely obsessed. I told everybody to read it. It was just so incredible. And these books are so different, and they're both so incredible. And I love seeing this because I feel like more and more writers are being encouraged to stay in one particular lane. Like, that's what you did well, so that's what you should do. And it's frustrating because we're creatives.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, well, thank you for saying they're completely different, because obviously that's something I, or maybe not obviously, but something that I think writers worry about a lot. And oftentimes things can feel very similar to you just because it's all coming from, you know, the same mind. So it's good to have a little feedback on that. But yeah, I think writers, and I guess I can only speak for myself in particular, you know, also say that to themselves. Like, you know, maybe certain writers are finding themselves being asked to write the same thing over and over again. But I think that's also maybe just how human psychology works, right? Like, especially with writing a novel, it's like something you don't really know how to do until you've done it. And then if you've done it once, you're like, okay, that worked. Like, let's do that again, you know, which might be true for a lot of professions and fields, right? Like, just repeat that same thing, whatever you just did, trust in that, right? And so I think that the tendency can be pretty strong, especially when beginning the next project, which can feel incredibly scary, right? And so you end up sort of defaulting into this mode, right? And you don't know, you know, for me, the anxiety was, is this my thing? Like, is grief, is, you know, with Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance, it's like, is grief, is writing about young people, coming of age stories, like, is that where I should live? Because that's the one thing I do really well. Or is that a launching point for something else, right? Or in what way can my writing evolve? So Yeah. So I don't know. I don't have the particular experience of having an editor or agent who's always asking me to repeat anything. So I can't really speak to that problem that I know some writers have out there.
Yeah. I mean, I keep changing genres. So my poor agent, it makes her life difficult. It makes publishing difficult. But I can't imagine just writing in one particular genre all the time. But besides that, the voices in these are so different. And The Wedding People, the humor is just so forward. Whereas in Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance, the humor was sort of bubbling under the surface. It was there all the time, but it wasn't as, you know, sort of forward as it is in The Wedding People. And I love when I read an author whose work I admire, and it feels almost like two different authors, but all the things that I love about their work is there. The heart is there. The soul is there. The personal universal elements are there. Whether it's grief after the fact, whether you're grieving a life you used to have while you're still living, all of those things that give me goosebumps and resonate, they're all there. And that's what I absolutely love. So we're going to discuss, well, we're focusing today on The Wedding People, and I will read that jacket copy shortly. But for our listeners, for those of you who haven't read Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance, you have got to add that to your TBR. And I do want to read you the jacket copy because there is a question I want to ask Alison when it comes to genre, which I know so many of our listeners struggle with. So here we go. The summer before Sally Holt starts the eighth grade begins as a gloriously uneventful one. It's full of family trips to the beach and long afternoons at the local pool with her older sister Kathy, which they mostly use as an excuse to ogle Billy Barnes, who works the concession stand there. A rising senior and local basketball star, Billy has been an unending source of intrigue for both girls since he jumped off the school roof in the fifth grade, and their fascination with him is one of the few things the increasingly different sisters have in common. By summer's end, Billy and Kathy are an item, an unthinkable stroke of luck that ends in an even more unthinkable tragedy. Set over the course of 15 years, Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance is narrated by Sally as she addresses Kathy before, during, and after her death. We watch as Kathy's absence creates a gaping hole that only Billy, now firmly off limits to Sally, understands and might possibly begin to fill. Charting years of their shared history and missed connections, Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance is both a breathtaking love story between two broken people who are unexplainably, inconveniently drawn to each other, and a wry, sharply observant coming-of-age story that looks at the ways the people we love most continue to shape our lives long after they're gone. So, I mean, I get goosebumps just reading the flap copy. It was just incredible. So for our listeners, why, Alison, was this book not marketed as YA when our characters are in the eighth grade and it spans, you know, 15 years and it's a coming of age? In terms of you, how did you pitch this book and what genre do you view it as?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's an interesting question. I personally don't think in genre terms that often when I'm writing. I mean, as a movie viewer, I'm like all genre. You know, I mean, that generally tends to be what I am thinking about in terms of, you know, when I'm consuming film. But with writing, I think when I start to think in terms of genre, I start to put too much pressure on myself, or it just creates a kind of anxiety that I don't find particularly productive for me in terms of my process. So I really just, as much as you can banish a thought from your own mind, I try to banish those thoughts. And I tell myself, well, you know, that's what my agent's for. That's what the publisher is for, right? Like, they will read it, they will diagnose it, right? Or they will, you know, they'll put a genre on it, or they won't. And that's their business. So, you know, I suppose that would be only helpful for someone who's out there struggling, you know, if the thought of what genre is this, if that question is producing anxiety or writer's block, right? I would just say, put it aside and trust that at some point down the line, there's someone who will help you find the answer to that question. And perhaps will know better than you, right, what the market is asking for and what readers are seeking in terms of genre or literary fiction.
Yeah, I love that you don't think about genre when you write. For our listeners who don't have agents, who don't have an editor, are able to say, okay, this is the genre this book is, perhaps, you know, you can then go to beta readers, etc., and be like, what kind of genre do you
feel this is after you've written it. I've done the same. I've written things and I'm like, I have no idea what the hell this is. What do you guys think it is? And they, you know, they feel like, oh, it's this or that. Did you find after it was published, Alison, that the book had crossover appeal? Did you find that you had some sort of teenage readers and some adult readers? How did that work?
Yeah, I do think there is some crossover appeal. And I think we do plan for that, or at least expect some of that to happen. But generally, when I give my books, I mean, this happened with The Adults as well, which was my first novel, and, you know, similar age range, young person kind of coming of age. And with The Adults and Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance, the feedback I've gotten from readers, both like readers in the business and also just friends, you know, people in the world who read, have often been like, oh, my daughter would love this, but she can't read it yet, you know, which to me is the first sign like, okay, this is not really fitting into genre fiction, simply just because maybe there's just stuff in there that's too mature or, you know, a little racy. And I'm not saying that about my own fiction necessarily, but just the feedback from the world has been not yet, or maybe she'll sneak it without me realizing it. So that's one side of things. The other thing I would say is, you know, when I am writing, when I have this imagined audience, you know, this question of, well, who is reading my books? I do often tend to think of someone like myself. So someone who is maybe interested in understanding the experience of youth from a distance, right? And almost like looking back and thinking, what the heck was that? Like, what was it being a teenager? Like, wait, what happened? That happened? Why did I do that? You know, so I found myself in my 20s and 30s having a lot of those questions. And those questions tended to just get me writing and kept me writing until I found myself a little bit closer to understanding the bittersweet mess that was my adolescence. And I don't know, you know, I don't know. I don't know if teenagers are interested in that question exactly. Maybe they are, you know, I'm sure there are some out there, but that to me sounds like the question of maybe an older woman.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think perhaps YA is the experience of being a teenager while you're in the fraught time of being a teenager. Whereas, you know, in terms of making sense of what being a teenager was and looking at it in hindsight with that adult's lens and the game perspective, I think that is what elevates it and, you know, puts it into a different genre in terms of making it more adult fiction or literary fiction, certainly. So for our listeners, I'm going to read you the jacket copy of the book we're discussing today, The Wedding People, so that we can break that down. It's a beautiful day in Newport, Rhode Island, when Phoebe Stone arrives at the Grand Cornwall Inn wearing a green dress and gold heels, not a bag in sight. She's immediately mistaken by everyone in the lobby for one of the wedding guests who have taken over the hotel, but she's actually the only one who isn't here for the big event. Phoebe is here because she's dreamed of coming for years. She had hoped to shuck oysters and take sunset sails with her husband, only now she's here alone at the lowest moment of her life. Meanwhile, the bride has accounted for every detail and every possible disaster the weekend might yield, except for, well, Phoebe, which makes it that much more surprising when the women can't stop confiding in each other. Soon, Phoebe is swept into the lives and the dysfunction of the wedding people, finding herself forever changed. Uproariously, absurdly funny, yet devastatingly tender, Alison S. Puck's The Wedding People is a look at the winding paths we take to places we never imagined and the chance encounters that help reroute us. So I love how Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance was over 15 years. And this book takes place in the space of a few days. You have the flashbacks to 2 years ago or however many years ago, 10 years ago. But in general, the action of the story takes place over 2 or 3 or 4 days. So can you speak a bit about adapting your mindset from a book that spanned decades to a book that spanned a few days?
Yeah. You know, I have a friend who always says, you know, every relationship you have is a reaction to your last one. So I think that's very true of novels as well. You know, The Wedding People, the short time span, keeping it in the present was really very much just a, like, I need to do the exact opposite of what I just did with Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance. But I will say I did start writing The Wedding People while writing Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance. So I published The Adults in 2011. Hopefully I'm not getting that year wrong, but it's generally it's 2011 or 2010. And I didn't publish Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance until 2022. So I had a 10-year lag of different phases, different things going on, different reasons for why I wasn't publishing. But I was always writing. And I was really just trying to figure out, like, what's the next story that I want to tell? And I started writing Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance. And that book was pretty heavy for me, I would say. You know, I mean, it's not based on, but it is sort of loosely inspired by some of the grief that I experienced as a teenager when my older brother passed away. And so I had been trying to write that story in some form or another for a very long time, partially because I was, you know, interested in exploring it as a sort of like, wait, what happened or what was that? But also, I think it was just a compulsion. Like, I just kept coming back to that story of a younger sibling losing the older sibling, right? Very suddenly, you know, a sort of before and after kind of adolescent experience. But I also really didn't want to write that story. So I kept pushing it off. You know, I mean, it was just this tug of war for years. And at some point during this tug of war, I just thought, why am I doing this to myself? You know, why write a story that spans all these years, that follows the psychological development of all these characters? You know, it's just too much. And so I was just like, I'm just going to write about a woman going to a hotel for like one night. I mean, originally, I think the novel was called like The Wedding Night, you know, and it was just like a 24-hour concentrated, like, let's just get this story done in a very short period of time. So I viewed it very much as a release, as a nice break, and something that I could conceive of accomplishing, which I really needed at that particular time when I felt like the project of Notes was just too big.
I love that, because we've had other writers who talk about how they cheat on their work in progress. Yeah. And sometimes they cheat completely and they never come back to the work in progress. But I love that sometimes.
Yeah, right.
Sometimes you need to just take a break from something, especially when it's really tough and you want to keep writing, but that story might just be too much at that particular moment. And writing something a bit lighter, you know, that might be a way to keep the creative juices flowing without necessarily giving up the story that you love. So I love going backwards and forwards. I think it must be difficult adjusting the voice accordingly, because again, The Wedding People is told in close third person, you know, whereas Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance is first person, a very voicey first person, but you've written a very voicey third person in The Wedding People as well. So can we speak about bringing a level of voice in us to third person? Because I think a lot of emerging authors think you can only do that in the first person.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting that you say that about sort of the cheating on the first book with the second book. And, you know, and I think that that is very much how it sort of feels. It's like this freedom, this liberation, this thing that you're not supposed to be doing. But then, you know, I mean, I don't think this is a spoiler because it's in all the promotional material of this book. But, you know, why is this woman showing up at this hotel? Oh, she's showing up at this hotel to end her life, right? So what started off as this fun fantasy, this happy short novel that I had conceived of, like, you know, I immediately went to this dark place and I realized, oh, okay, I can't avoid the dark places in my life. That's what I was trying to do in leaving Notes behind. You know, I thought, okay, there's a different path, a lighter path, a happier path. And I just ran into the same problem, right? So I went back to finishing Notes because I thought, you know, that's actually the story that I'm currently invested in. And I'll deal with that mess at the hotel later. And so I think some of the voice, you know, the third person, again, you know, trying to get out of the head of this young person, right? That's really where I wanted to flee from. And so the third person did offer me the illusion of that at first, right? Like, I'm just looking at this woman. I am not this woman. I am not stuck inside her mind. But again, like, just realizing you can't get away from that either. Like, you do have to dip into your mind. Yeah.
I'm laughing when you say you're not stuck inside her mind, because there is so much interiority in this book. For our listeners who are trying to write characters who spend so much time by themselves, where they are just stuck in their thoughts and their mind, please read this book, because it's an excellent way of doing that while still moving the plot forward, while still keeping the reader curious, while still engaging them. And there's times that I felt a bit claustrophobic in her thoughts, even though it wasn't first person.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, I think I felt that as a writer too. But I think it's helpful to have, you know, I keep talking about these things that I'm trying to avoid as a writer, these fears or these anxieties that pop up. And at some point in my life, they certainly stopped me and caused me a lot of grief. Now I really try to use them productively. So if I'm writing the third person and, you know, the third person limited, right, and making it really attached to one particular person's point of view, and it's like the creating that feeling that you're saying, right, of using the first person, but not, right, that interiority. Well, then what am I afraid of? Why do I keep resisting it, right? And I'm afraid of exactly that, right? This claustrophobia or getting stuck too long, ruminating on a thought, right? So as soon as I realize that that's what I'm afraid of doing as a writer, I'm aware of it now, right? And so then I ask myself, okay, well, where am I doing that? And how can I control that? And how can I minimize that? Or maybe we do need to move the scene along at this point instead of ruminating on this television show that she's watching for another two pages, right? And obviously you're reading the edited version. I mean, my editor had to read a lot more of Phoebe's interiority and figure out, okay, this is where I really felt like I was stuck in an elevator with this woman and I wanted out. So yeah, just, I guess my point is really just, you know, as soon as you feel a fear, as soon as you feel something pop up, like, oh no, like, don't stop, right? Actually look at whatever that is. Like, what are you telling yourself and why? And how can you try to use that almost like the voice of the editor and not the voice of the evil demon who wants to ruin your life and career.
Yeah, the interiority was so incredible. And, you know, we say it all the time on the podcast when we critique inquiry letters and opening pages, that this is how you get to know a character, what they think about, what they fixate on, what they obsess over, what they don't want to think about, what they avoid, what makes them feel uncomfortable, what they notice about other people. All of these things reveal so much about character, and that's what makes them singular. And that's why interiority is so important, as well as obviously emotionality. I want to speak as well, Alison, we don't have much time left, but I want to speak about having an inciting incident that is off the page and that is alluded to and that we only find out about 50 pages in. So I just want to read a very short paragraph here for our listeners. So this is with Phoebe. It goes, "But that morning before she got on the plane, Phoebe woke and knew she was no longer normal. Yet she made toast, took a shower, dried her hair, gathered her lecture notes for a second day of the fall semester, opened her closet and looked at all the clothes she once bought simply because they looked like shirts a professor should wear to work. Rows of solid colored blouses, the female versions of things her husband wore. She pulled out a gray one, held it up in front of the mirror, but could not bring herself to put it on. Could not go to work and stand at the office printer and hold her face in a steady expression of interest while her colleague talked at length about the surprising importance of cheese in medieval theology. Instead, she slipped on the emerald dress, the gold heels from her wedding, the thick pearls her husband had lain across her eyes like a blindfold on their wedding night. She got on a plane, drank an impressively good gin and tonic, and it was so nice and cool down her throat, she hardly felt her blisters exiting the plane." Now, we say that a story needs an inciting incident to answer the why now, why today question. You know, so this character has, I think her husband left her like 2 years ago. He left her for somebody else. She's been depressed the whole time. But today's the day that she chooses to leave her life and do this thing. And we have to wonder, why not last week? Why not next week? And I kept reading to find out, okay, what was the thing that made it today? And then on page 50, I found out what the thing is that makes it today. And I loved how you could have started with the thing that happened, that kicked it off when she was like, she drank that night and the next day she gets on the plane, but you leave us wondering. So can you speak a bit about starting with that kind of catalyst that is then used to fuel curiosity in the reader to help them keep turning pages?
That place where you just read from, where she's sort of getting ready for work and deciding, no more. That was the place I started writing from when I started years ago, just sort of getting her from her old life into her new life, which is sort of symbolized by the hotel in Newport and sort of the present forward moving action of the novel. But I just kept feeling like, no, I just want this to be clean. I want it to start in the hotel. I want it to start when she shows up to the hotel. And as soon as she leaves, the story's over. And I didn't know why yet. And I didn't know how that was going to happen. But in my mind, that's really the shape of it. I had a professor in graduate school who would often say, as long as you know the shape of your novel, you're okay, right? You don't need to know all the plot points. You don't need to know how you're going to figure out the whole messy middle. But if you can like just see it like as a shape, as a rectangle or a spiral or overlapping circles, can be anything, right? You know what you're doing. And that felt very true to me. So once I opened it with her entering the hotel, I started to find myself interested in all these new questions. Like, wait, why is she here? And what is she risking by being here? And what is she going to change because she's here? What is she going to ruin? And possibly, what is she going to make better because she's here? And as a writer, you know, you need those questions, especially a writer of a novel. It's like, you need those questions like fuel, right? To keep you interested. The same way, you know, you want to be wondering things when you're reading a good book, the same way you want to be wondering things when you're watching a great movie, right? So I'm the kind of writer who doesn't overly outline for that reason. Like, I do need to keep some of the mystery alive for me. Otherwise, I will just, you know, put it down and go to the grocery store or something.
I'm exactly the same. If I know everything, I'm not interested in writing it, right? I write it to find out all these things. Last question. We say that it helps to give a character something they want at the beginning of the story, and there need to be stakes attached. And that's exactly what you were talking about now. What's at risk? What does she stand to lose? What does she stand to gain? And I say that we should give characters something they want at the beginning of chapters and the beginning of scenes as well. It doesn't need to be world peace, something huge, even if they just want to go down and take a dip in a hot tub, right? That gives them something they want. And that changes throughout the novel. And what they want isn't always necessarily what they need. And with the character arc, they'll find out what they need. But that also leads to causality in terms of plot points. It needs to be that X leads to Y, which leads to Z, as opposed to having satellite plot points that are just randomly happening around this character. Now, in this book, there is a lot happening around her. She's got to deal with this bride who's dealing with a lot, and the bride is going off on tangents and stuff. So it almost feels like satellite plot points, but everything that happens with the bride is affecting Phoebe as well in terms of tipping the dominoes over. So can you speak a bit about that, like wants, needs, stakes, and how that leads to plot points?
Yeah, you know, I mean, as I've gotten older as a writer, I just really love a book that starts off with strong desire, right? Like whatever it is. And, you know, one of the things I love the most is when the desire is really small. Like, and one of the challenges or the prompts that I give my students a lot is, you know, imagine like the most pathetic or smallest or least worthy desire and just make it, you know, the big want of the story. Like, Joe wants a cup of coffee, right? Like, how can you make that the premise of the whole book, right? And I think that the way you do that is thinking about that causality. Well, okay, he wants this cup of coffee, and now because he's on his way to get it, something happens, right? So, and had he not been on his way to get it, his life would have remained the same. But because he went, X happened, and then Y, and then Z, and then ta-da, you know, you have this whole other life that Joe is living, right? So that to me is just so much fun as a reader and as a writer. This is a pretty big desire that she has. So it's not a cup of coffee, right? It's, you know, plans to end her life. I want to leave my whole life behind, right? These are not small things. And so I think for that reason, because it was so big and such a planned out event for Phoebe. I mean, she's really a professor type, right? Like planned it out like a lecture plan, like it has to go like this. Otherwise it will not be the beautiful death that I want, right? That I envision for myself. And so I had a lot of fun playing around with the small, tiny things that would alter her plan. And you know, the small thing would be something like, there's no room service tonight because of the wedding. And she had envisioned this like decadent meal arriving to her room and she's hungry. And it's, you know, just like that small like hint of hunger is going to alter what she's thinking. And then maybe sort of bigger things like encountering the bride and realizing that, you know, if I do this, then it's going to ruin this woman's wedding, right? And is that something I'm willing to engage with, right? So I loved thinking about the way that the bride and Phoebe like would have this constant evolving effect on each other, right? Just the small little things that they do or say changes everything, right? And if you kind of follow that logic all the way through, it's sort of incremental and it makes sense that you end up where we end up, right? But if you're not thinking about that, if you're just like, well, how did it go from A to B by the end, right? It would seem sort of really outlandish and hard to conceive. And I think our lives work that way too.
I was just going to say that real life is that way. Our lives are changed by the small decision to rush to the store for milk and something happens and we weren't anticipating that or whatever, you know. We think our lives are changed by these big earth-shattering decisions, but most often it's the tiny little things. And I love seeing that in the book, how this big need is chipped away. It's eroded constantly by smaller things. And then her need evolves and her wants evolve as the book goes on. Were you ever tempted, Alison, to write it as a dual POV with Lila and with Phoebe? Or was it always Phoebe is the star of the show?
Yeah, I was tempted to do almost everything.
I love that.
Yeah. And actually, you know, started to do everything, tried to do everything, and then either ran out of time or energy. So sometimes I just rely on that. Like, I just am physically exhausted. It has to just be Phoebe. But yeah, I was really in love with the vision of this novel that had many points of view, like, because it's such a big cast. It's an ensemble cast, a wedding. You have all these side characters that I would get like overly involved with. But I could write a short story from their perspective. I could write maybe a scene from their perspective, but I just kept wanting to go back into this woman's mind, you know, because she has the privileged point of view in this world, right? And that's the view of the outsider. And she's an outsider in so many different ways, right? I mean, if you're a woman walking into a wedding hotel and you're not invited and you're not part of the family and you're not a friend and you don't even have enough money really to stay at this hotel, the only reason you can stay there is because you're ending your life, so it doesn't matter, right? You're going to have a point of view that no one else at that hotel is going to have on this particular wedding. You're going to be able to point things out, you know, that perhaps the bride can't see because she's so lost in the world of her wedding. And you're also going to be incredibly honest. I mean, Phoebe, one of the reasons I kept getting drawn back to her was because she was so frank. She was so honest, so willing, finally, for the first time in her life, to just say whatever she wanted. And that perspective I really enjoyed. And I think is something that the other characters needed. I mean, because you kind of need, I used to work at weddings in graduate school. And I, you know, they would always tell me to dress for the event, which meant I wore a cocktail party dress. So I looked like a wedding guest, but I was always just leaning against a photo booth. And so it was very confusing to the other guests, because they thought, you know, they would come over to me and chat like about the, you know, do the, oh, this is such a great night, you know, whatever. And then they would find out I didn't care at all, right? And had no stakes in this wedding. And they started being honest with me, you know, started giving me the juicy bits of what's going on here. And because I was the stranger. So this is very much a novel that needs to be in the stranger's point of view as we watch the stranger become increasingly familiar and absorbed by what's going on here.
Yeah, I love that. So again, for our listeners, you need to be so intentional with your narrator. Why is that person the narrator of the story and no one else? And so long as you can answer that question for yourself, you've chosen the right narrator, as opposed to just, oh, I kind of like this person. Right, Alison, I've taken up a lot of your time. For our listeners, we are linking to The Wedding People on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you get it there, you support an independent bookstore, you support the podcast and the author at the same time. Alison, thank you so much. I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you so much, Bianca. This has been a real pleasure.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Litera Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Litera Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. Now, this particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 30th of September, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of October. For more information and to register, go to biancamurray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab.
Did you know that 70% of all books, including those traditionally published, are sold online via e-commerce? If you're an author wondering how you can get some of that market share, this is for you. Hi, I'm your co-host, Carly Waters, and I'm here to tell you how writers can work on their author brand and build an audience and convert those followers into book buyers. Ever wonder why so many authors publish books and later say that they didn't sell as many copies as they wanted? It happens over and over, and we see it all over social media. Authors think it's a them problem, but not always. They just weren't shown the way. And I don't want you guys to launch a book and show up at book events and have two people in the chairs. I've helped clients launch client books to the bestseller list for 15 years and have built a 6-module, 11-hour course with all of my knowledge that will give you the craft and book business information that you simply won't find anywhere else. And there's an app plus monthly Q&A sessions with me. 200 of you have already joined my new course. And as writer Siobhan Moore said, I'm halfway through the course and grieving that I didn't have this information sooner. There's really nowhere else to find it. Worth every penny. If you want the info that will change the course of your writing career, go to carlywaters.com/course to learn more and use discount code POD15, that's POD15 at checkout. That's POD15 at checkout over at carlywaters.com/course. I'll see you there.